ogle, and otherwise run his lucrative trade. More than 20 men stood in a loose group around Harlan. Most were stevedores and dock labourers in Morpal's employ. The others were flit pilots, gig men, hoy drivers and riggers, who'd stopped in for caffeine, fuel and a game of cards, many of them regulars who were into Morpal for more than a year's salary each. All this and more was visible from their collective thoughts, which swirled around the loading dock like a fog. I was 5 kilometres away, in a room in a low-rent hotel, but it was clear enough. I knew what Mingus Futier had eaten for breakfast, what Fancy Man Decree had stolen the night before, the lie Gert Geraghty had told his wife. I knew all about the thing Eric Klaas didn't want to tell Morpal. Whiston Frauke sat beside me, smoking a low stick, his limiter activated. He was reading a tremendous, tedious, erotic novel on his slate. Surface was easy. Deep mind was harder. Morpal, who moves, and his cronies were well used to concealing their secrets. That was why Harlan had gone in first. Morpal finally arrived at a decision. He had determined, I sensed, to take the moral high ground.
"This is not how things are done on my platform," he told Harlan. "This is a respectable establishment."
"Yeah, right," snorted Nail. "One last time. What can you tell me about Victor Zan? He worked here once, before he went off planet. I know he worked here, because I had the records checked out. So tell me about Victor."
"Victor Zan hasn't been around in 5 years," Morpal said.
"Tell me about him anyway," Nail snapped.
"I really don't see any reason to do that."
"I'll show you one."
Nail reached his free hand into his hip pocket, took something out, and threw it down onto the cup-ringed, grimy tabletop. His badge of authority. The signet crest of the Inquisition. Immediately, all the men took a step back, alarmed. I felt Morpal's mind start in dismay. This was the kind of trouble no one wanted, unless... "Damn it," I said. Frauke looked up from the midst of his book's latest loveless tryst. "What's up?" "Morpal, who moves, is about to make a miscalculation." "Oh, dear," said Frauke, and turned back to his novel. Morpal had run the dock for 46 years. For all his misdeeds and misdemeanors, some of them serious, he'd never run foul of the law, apart from the odd fine or reprimand. He actually thought he could deal with this and get away with it. "Harlan, Morpal's signal will be a double finger click. Your immediate threat is the gray-haired gig man to your left, who has a dart knife. To his right, in the leather apron, the rigger has a pivot gun, but he will not be able to draw it as fast. The flit pilot in green wants to prove himself to Morpal, and he won't hesitate. His friend, the one with the obscura-tinted eyes, is less confident, but he has a boom gun in his cab."
"Well?"
Harlan Nail asked. Morpal, who moves, clicked both middle fingers. I flinched at the sudden flare of adrenaline and aggression. A great part of it came from Nail. The rigger in the leather apron had drawn his pivot gun, but Nail had already stoved the table in with the face of the grey-haired gig man and relieved him of his dart knife. Nail threw himself around as the pilot in green lunged forwards and slam-kicked him in the throat. The pilot went down, choking, his larynx crushed, as the pivot gun finally boomed. The homemade round whipped high over Nail's head as he rolled and triggered the dart knife. The spring-propelled blade speared the rigger through the center of his leather apron, and he fell over on his back, clawing at his belly. Others ploughed in, one striking Nail in the ribs with an 8-wrench. "Ow!" Nail grunted, and laid the man out. The obscura fiend was running across the platform towards his hoy. Nail threw another man aside, and grabbed the edges of Morpal's boy chair. The mover yelled in dismay as Nail slung the frictionless chair sideways. It sped across the platform like a quoit, knocking two of the stevedores over, and slammed hard against the dock's restraining rail. The serious impact dazed Morpal. He slumped forwards. Nail backfisted a man in the nose, and then punched out another who was trying to flee anyway. Two front teeth flew into the air. The obscura fiend had his hoy's door open, reaching in. A stevedore with a hatchet swung at Nail, forcing him to jump back. Nail blocked the next swing with his forearm, fractured the man's sternum with a jab, and threw him with a crash into the nearby row of porcelain samovars. The obscura addict turned from his cab and racked the grip of his boom gun. He brought it up to fire. Nail slid the Hecuta 10 from his body glove and calmly shot him through the head at 15 meters. Blood splashed up the rusted fender of the hoy. The man cannoned backwards, dropping the boom gun from dead fingers. The rest of them scattered. Kara ran onto the platform, her weapon raised. It had taken her just 30 seconds to move out of cover at my command to back up Nail, but the fight was already done.
"Don't leave any for me, then," she complained.
"You should have been here," Nail said.
He walked over to the rig and picked up the fallen boom gun, examining it.
"Nice," he said.
"Harlan."
Nail looked over at Morpal, who was just coming round. The back of his boy chair rammed against the platform's rail. He saw Nail, saw him aiming the weapon.
"Harlan, no."
But Nail's blood was up. The need for vengeance, suppressed for so long, was finally finding an outlet. Nail fired. Morpal had ducked. The shot exploded the seat back above him and the rail behind. The force of the impact drove the boy chair backwards. Intact, unscathed, but still sitting in his chair, Morpal, who moves, went backwards, toppled, and fell into the interstack gulf.
"Well, damn,"
Nail hissed.
"For throne's sake, Nail, I told you not to—"
Thonius had just walked into the hotel room behind me.
"Good book?"
he asked Frauke.
"Saucy,"
Frauke replied, not looking up.
"Nail's just ruined our lead."
"Never mind,"
Thonius grinned, a smug satisfaction on his face.
"It was pointless anyway. I found a much better one."
5. She knew for certain it was Rigorous Nil, even before he opened the oubliette hatch. Just part of her gift, the same thing that allowed her to win at cards or guess which hand a coin was in.
"Come, you,"
he said. A glow globe coded to Nil's biotrace bobbed at his shoulder and cast its cheap yellow light into the cell. Patience got up and stepped out into the hallway, making a big show of dusting down her garments.
"They'll be dirtier yet,"
Nil remarked, closing the heavy black iron door.
"The dinner's over, and the prefect wants the pots doing."
Nil chuckled and pushed her down the hallway. The glow globe followed obediently. There was little to like about Rigorous Nil. In his days as an Imperial Guardsman, he had been big and powerful, but age and a lack of exercise had sunk his muscles into slabby fat, hunching him over. His teeth were black pegs, and a scarred, concave section of his skull explained both the end of his soldiering career and his simpleton's nature. Nil was proud of his past, and still wore his medal on his chest. He liked to regale the pupils with accounts of the glorious actions he had seen, and got angry when they mocked him and pointed out inconsistencies in his stories. But he wasn't the worst by a long way. Skinny, rigorous suzerain had such a short temper and love of the flail that the pupils believed he had once been a commissar. Rigorous Ockwell was rather too fond of the younger girls. And then there was Rigorous Ide, of course.
"So, I'm to wash pots?" Patience asked.
"Get on,"
Nil grumbled and gave her a cuff. Like all the rigorists, Nil wore a knotted leather flail and a longer wooden baton suspended from his wide leather belt. The flail was for minor punishments, the baton a more serious disciplinary tool. Nil, who trusted his fists, seldom used either. Many of Prefect Cyrus's long morning sermons revolved around the symbology of the rigorists' twin instruments, likening them to the paired heads of the Holy Aquila, voices of different pitch and measure through which the dogmas of the Golden Throne might be communicated in complementary ways. In the Kindred Youth Scholam, most lessons seemed to require some corporal component. They ascended the draughty stone stairs and passed through the unlit lesson halls of the seventh remove. The narrow hallways between classrooms were formed by partly glazed wooden partitions. The glass in the frames was stained by the colour of tobacco by the passage of the years. Then Nil unlocked the door to the next ascent.
"I thought I was wanted for scullion duties,"
Patience said.
"The prefect would clap eyes on you first,"
replied Nil, and jerked his head upwards. Patience sighed, and began to trudge up the winding stairs ahead of Nil's light. She knew what that meant. A quiz from the prefect on the error of her ways. If she was lucky, she'd get away with an apology to Tutor Abelard, and a few lacrimos mea in the chapel under the prefect's instruction before she spent the night in the pot room, freezing her hands in the greasy sop tubs. If she was unlucky, there would be Suzerain and his flail. Or Ide. It took them over 20 minutes to climb the meandering tower to the upper vaults. In the main chamber there, servants and a few chosen pupils were clearing the last dregs of the feast. The air was still warm and scented with rich cooking smells. Prefect Cyrus did not stint when important visitors came to the Skolam. He even provided wine and amasek, and did not complain when manufactory directors lit up pipes and low sticks. Patients could smell the spicy smoke lingering in the long room. 2 young pupils from the 6th remove were team-folding the white cloths from the feast tables. A tutor, Runciman, was supervising them and explaining the geometry of the correct fold angles.
"Wait,"
Nil told her, and left her in the doorway. He shambled off down the length of the long beamed hall, his light tagging along after him like a will-o'-wisp. Patients waited. Edgy, arms folded. 3 young children ran out past her, their arms full of candlesticks, napkin rings threaded around their tiny wrists. 1 glanced up at her, eyes wide. Nil reached the far end of the room. Prefect Cyrus was sitting at the high table still, a swell glass in his hand, talking quietly with a stranger in a dark red robe. 1 of the knight's visitors, a gilder or a mill owner, perhaps. Clearly a man of wealth and breeding, well-groomed. He was listening to the prefect intently, sipping something from a tall crystal beaker. To his left, apart from the conversation, sat another man, another stranger. This man was short, but powerfully made, his cropped hair ginger in the lamplight, his body glove traced with silver. He was smoking a low stick, and gazing with half-interest at the ancient, flaking murals on the chamber walls. From her vantage point, patients could see that the ginger-haired man wore an empty holster on his hip. Prefect Cyrus did not permit firearms inside the Skolam, but that holster suggested the ginger-haired man was a bodyguard, a paid protector. The man in red was evidently even more important than she had first suspected, if he could afford his own muscle. Then patience saw Ide. The rigorist was standing at the far end of the chamber, waiting. He was staring right at her. She shuddered. Tall, strong, Ide was a brute. His eyes were always half open, and he wore his white blonde hair in a long, shaggy mane, secured at the nape by a silver buckle. Ide was the only rigorist who never bragged about his guard days. Patience had a nasty idea why. Nil spoke briefly to the prefect, who excused himself to the man in red, and walked down to the center of the hall, Nil at his heels. The prefect gestured that Patience should come join him. She approached obediently until they were face to face. Prefect Cyrus was anything between 40 and 400. Slim and well-made, he had undergone many programs of juvenat work, making his flesh over-tight and his skin hideously smooth and pink. His eyes were violet and, Patience believed, deliberately sculpted by the org chemists to appear kind and fatherly. His blue robes were perfectly pressed and starched. When he smiled, his implanted teeth were as white as ice. He was smiling now. "Patience," he whispered. She could smell the oil of cloves he wore to scent his body.
"My prefect," she answered with effort.
"You flinch. Why do you flinch?" She could not say it was because rigorist Ide had just taken the first few steps on his way to join them.
"I broke the rules, and committed an affront to the person of Tutor Abelard. I flinch as I await my punishment."
"Patience," the prefect said. "Your punishment is over. You've been set in the oubliette, have you not?" He looked around at Nil. "She has been in the oubliette all night, hasn't she, Nil?"
"That is so, prefect," replied Nil with a nod.
"All done, then. No need to flinch."
"Then why am I here?"
Patience asked. "I have good news," the prefect said, "and I wanted to share it with you as soon as possible. Good, good news that I'm sure will lift your heart as surely as it has lifted mine."
"What is it?"
"Patience, places have been secured this night for your dear sisters. Serving in the hall this evening, they so won the admiration of a merchant lord, one of our guests. He offered them indenture on the spot." Patience blinked.
"My sisters?"
"Have taken wing at last, Patience.
Their particulars are all signed and contracted. Their new life has already begun.
No, that's not right, Patience said sharply. They're too young. They haven't yet reached maturity. I won't allow it.
It is already done, the prefect said, his face showing no sign of annoyance.
Then undo it, Patience said. Right now. Undo it. I should have been consulted. They are in my charge.
Patience, you were detained in the oubliette for your own wrongdoings. I decided the matter. Your sisters are long departed, and I trust you will wish them well in your prayers this night.
No, she shouted.
Shut your hole, warned Nil,
stepping forwards, his light bobbing after him.
No need for that, Nil, said Cyrus.
The prefect gazed at Patience.
I am rather surprised by your response, Patience. I had thought you would be pleased.
She glowered at him.
You cheated me. You knew I wasn't around to object. This is wrong. They are too young.
I tire of this, Patience. There is no rule or law that says girls of your sister's age may not be contracted. Such an agreement is in my power.
It isn't. You can only authorize a contract of employ in the case of an orphan lacking the appropriate blood kin. That's the law. I've only stayed here this long to supervise their well-being, you bastard!
Take her away, Nil, said the prefect.
Don't even think about it, Nil, Patience warned. I want his name, Cyrus, the name of this man who has taken my sisters.
Oh, and for what good?
I am of majority. I can leave this stinking tower whenever I choose. Give me the name. Now I will find him and secure the release of my sisters.
Prefect Cyrus turned to Nil.
Another period in the oubliette, I feel.
Yes, sir.
Oh, no, said Patience, backing away. You can't touch me now. Not now. I've stuck by the Skolem's frigging rules this long, one way or another, for the good of my sisters. But you have no hold on me. I am an adult, with the rights of an adult. Go frig yourself, Cyrus. I'm leaving.
Double the period for that vile language, Cyrus barked.
Double this, stink breath,
Patience cried, making a gesture one of the potboys had taught her. Nil lunged at her, arms wide. She ducked sideways, putting a little of her gift into the kick she slammed at the old soldier's belly. Nil lurched away and crashed into a table, knocking pewterware onto the floor, anxiously steadying himself against the table's edge in surprise. Somehow, Ide had got behind her. The blow from his baton, swung two-handed, caught her across the back of the skull and dropped her to her hands and knees. Patience blacked out for a brief moment, and blood streamed down her nose onto the flagstones. She felt Ide's big hand crush her left shoulder as it grabbed her.
"Never did live up to your name,"
she heard Ide murmur. Her name. Not Patience. The one little piece of her life she still owned entirely. Ide was swinging the baton down again to smack her shoulders. She froze his hand. Ide gasped, sweating, terrified, as an invisible force slowly pulled his powerful arm back and drew the baton away from her. She let it smash Ide in the face. He staggered back with an anguished cry, blood spurting from his mangled nose. Then she was on her feet, flicking her head back hard so that the blood from her nose spattered out in a shower. Nil was coming for her. So was the prefect. Someone was crying an alarm. Patience looked at Nil, and he flew backwards through the air, slamming into the table again so hard it went over with him. She looked at Cyrus and snarled as she simultaneously burst all the blood vessels in his face. He fell down on his knees, whimpering.
"You bastards!" she was screaming. "My sisters! You bastards!"
Ide swung at her again. He was crazy mad now, trying to kill her. Patience held out a hand, and Ide went sprawling over on his back, and continued to slide down the length of the hallway until his skull crashed into the stone doorpost. Rigorous Suzerain had appeared from somewhere, his flail raised as he ran at her. Nil was clambering to his feet. Patience ducked Suzerain's first slash, then hurled him backwards a few steps with a twitch of her mind. She was getting tired now. Nil thundered forwards.
"I'll take that," Patience said,
and ripped the medal from Nil's tunic with a mental flick. She slapped her outspread palms against Nil's dented skull and blasted him away into the murals. The ancient plasterwork cracked under the heavy impact, and Nil fell limp onto the floor. Suzerain came in again. Nil's medal was still hanging in the air. Patience whipped it around and buried it in Suzerain's cheek. He fell down with a wail of pain, blood pouring from the long gouge.
"I've seen enough," said the man in the red robe. The ginger-haired man rose to his feet and turned off his limiter. Patience shrieked as her gift went away completely. It was as if her strength had been shut off. A hard vacuum formed and popped in her soul. She had never met an untouchable before. Staggering, she turned. The ginger-haired man came towards her, his hands open and loose.
"Let's go, darling," he said.
She threw a punch at him. She felt so weak. He caught it and hit her in the face. The blow seemed effortless, but she fell hard, barely conscious. The ginger-haired man leaned over and pinched a nerve point that left her paralyzed. Blind, helpless, she heard Prefect Cyrus being helped back onto his feet.
"You were right, Cyrus," she heard the man in red say. "An excellent subject. An unformed telekine. The gamists will pay well for this. I have no objection to meeting your price of 10,000.
"Agreed, Locter," the prefect sniffed. Just get her out of my sight."
Playing Patience. 6. Carl Thonius was patently pleased with himself.
"Consider the names again. Victor Zahn, Noble Soto, Goodman Frell. The four names are all names, yes, but they're also all simple, virtuous. The sort of solid, strong, aspirational names a high-born master, for example, might give to his slaves."
"These men were slaves?" Kara asked.
"Not exactly," said Carl. "But I think they're all given names, not birth names."
Carl had a particular talent in the use of cogitators and logic engines. Since our arrival, he had spent many hours in the census archives of Urbitane.
"I've been tracing the file records of all three men. It's laborious work, and the records are, no tittering at the back, incomplete. The names are officially logged and genuine, but they are not connected to any local bloodlines. Soto, Zahn, and Frell are all common names here on Sameter, but there is no link between any of these men and any family or families carrying those names. In other words, I believe they chose the surnames themselves. They chose common local surnames."
"Fake identities," Nail shrugged. "Not much of a lead, then."
"Says the man who pushed our last decent lead off a kilometer-high ledge," Carl mocked.
Nail gave him a threatening look, and the interrogator shrugged.
"No, not fake identities. The evidence points to the fact that all three men were orphans, probably from the slums. They were raised in a poorhouse, or maybe a charitable institution, where they were given their virtuous forenames. On leaving the poorhouse, as young adults, they were obliged to choose and adopt surnames so that they could be registered on the citizenry roll and be legally recognized."
"Odd that he employed three men with the same background," Kara said. She could not bring herself to utter Moloch's name.
"Curious indeed," I agreed. "Carl, I don't suppose you managed to identify the institutions that raised them."
"Throne, you don't want March, do you?"
Carl laughed. He beamed like a conjurer showing off a sleight-of-hand marvel.
"Of course I did. And they all came from the same one, a darling little place called the Kindred Youth Skolam."
Nail left the hotel room almost immediately and headed off to scare up some transport for us. For the first time in months, I felt my team moving with a sense of focus, so refreshingly different from the blunt-edged vengeance that had spurred them since Majescus. Carl deserved praise. He had diligently uncovered a trail that gave us refined purpose once again. We had been so squarely and murderously outplayed by the heretic Zygmunt Moloch. I had been pursuing him for a long time, but at Majescus he stopped running and turned to face me. The ensuing clash, most of which took place aboard my chartered starship, the Hinterlight, left over half the crew dead. Among them, trapped by Moloch's malicious evil, were three of my oldest, most trusted retainers: Will Tallowhand, Nora St. Jack, and Elena Coy. Badged with their blood, triumphant, the bastard Moloch had escaped. I had lost friends before, We all had. Serving the orders of the Holy Inquisition was a dangerous and often violent calling. I myself, more than most, can vouch for the cost to life and limb. But Majescus was a particularly searing blow. Moloch's assault had been ingeniously vicious and astoundingly callous, even by the standards of such vermin. It was as if he had a special genius for spite. I had vowed not to rest until I had found him again and exacted retribution in full. In truth, when I came to Sameter, I did not think I was an imperial inquisitor at all. I am not ashamed to admit that for a brief while my duty to the God Emperor had retreated somewhat, replaced by a more personal fire. I was Gideon Ravener, burning to avenge his friends. The same, I knew, was true of my four companions. Harlan and Kara had known Alina Coy since their days together in the employ of my former master Eisenhorn. Harlan had also formed a particular bond of friendship with the mercurial Will Tallowhand. In Nora St. Jack, Thonius had enjoyed the stimulating company of a mind as quick and clever as his own. There would be no more devilish games of regicide, no more late-night debates on the respective merits of the later Helican poets. Anthonius was yet young. These were the first comrades he had lost in the line of duty. Even Whiston Frauke was in mourning. Louche and taciturn, Frauke was an unloved, unlovely man who made no friends because of his untouchable curse. But Alina Coy had been an untouchable too, one of nature's rare psychic blanks and the last of Eisenhorn's distaff. There had been a relationship there, one neither of them ever chose to disclose, presumably a mutual need created by their shared status as outsiders, pariahs. He missed her. In the weeks after Majescus, he said less than usual and smoked all the time, gazing into distances and shadows. Aboard the hired transport, a small grey cargo gig with whistling fansail engines, we moved west through the Hive City. Carl linked his data slate to my chair's input, and I reviewed his information concerning the Skolam. It had been running for many years, ostensibly a worthy charity school, struggling to provide housing and basic levels of education for the most neglected section of Urbitane's demographic. There were millions, nay, billions of institutions like it all across the Imperium, wherever hives rose and gross poverty loomed. Many were run by the Ecclesiarchy, or tied to some scheme of work by the Departamento Munitorum, or the Imperial Guard itself. Some were missionary endeavours, established by zealous social reformers, some political initiatives, some just good, four-square community efforts to assist the downtrodden and underprivileged. And some were none of those things. Carl and I inspected the records of the kindred youth Skolam carefully. On the surface, it was respectable enough. Its register audits were a matter of public record, and it applied for and received the right grants and welfare support annually, which meant that the administratum subjected it to regular inspection. It was approved by the Munitorum, and held all the appropriate stamps and marks of a legitimate charitable institution. It had an impressive portfolio of recommendations and references from many of Urbitane's worthies and nobles. It had even won several rosettes of distinction from the Missionaria. But scratch any surface. "You'll like this," said Carl. "The prefect, he's one Berto Cyrus. His official file is spotless and perfectly in order, but I think it's a graft." A graft. A legitimate dossier that has been expertly designed to overfit previous records and eclipse them. Done well, and this had been done brilliantly, a graft would be more than adequate to bypass the administratum. But we servants of the Holy Ordos had greater and more refined tools of scrutiny to bring to bear. Carl showed me the loose ends and rough edges that had been tucked away to conceal the basic deception, the long, tortuous strands of inconsistency that no one but the Inquisition would ever think to check, for the effort would be too labor-intensive. That was ever the failing of the Imperium's monumental administratum. Overseeing hives the size of Urbitane, even an efficient and ordered division of the administratum could only hope to keep up with day-to-day processing. There was no time for deeper insight. If one wanted to hide something from the Imperial Administratum, one simply had to place it at the end of a long line of diversions and feints, so far removed from basic inspections that no administrative clerk would ever notice it. "He's older than he pretends to be," said Carl. "Far older. Here's the giveaway.
three digits different in his 12-digit citizenry numeric, but changed here, at birth registry date, where no one would ever go back to look. Berto Cyrus was actually a stillborn infant. The prefect took over the identity. Which makes him 88 years older than his record states, and therefore makes him, in fact, Ludovic Cairo, a cognite-schooled heretic wanted on 5 worlds.
Cognite, throne of earth.
I said you'd like it. Carl smiled. And here's the other thing. Its implications are not very pleasant.
Go on.
Given the Skolam's throughput of pupils over the years, very, very few are still evident in the city records.
They've disappeared.
That's too strong a word. Not accounted for would be a better term. The ex-pupils have dropped off the record after their time at the Skolam, so there's no reason anyone scrutinizing the school's register in an official capacity should question it. Pupils leave, sign up indentures, contracts, hold employees, but then these documents lead nowhere.
From which you deduce what?
I asked, though I could see Carl had the answer ready in the front of his mind. The Skolam is a front. It's laundering children and young adults, raising them, training them, nurturing them, and then moving them as a commodity into other hands. The fact that the pupils are only known by their Skolam names means that they can be slipped away unnoticed. It's quite brilliant.
Because they take in anonymous children, give them new identities to provide them with legal status, and then sell them on under cover of perfectly correct and perfectly untraceable paperwork.
Just so,
said Carl. What do they do with them? I wondered.
Whatever they like, would be my guess, said Whiston, glancing up from his tawdry book. I hadn't even realized he'd been listening.
Those three we're tracking. They ended up as hired guns, probably because they were handy in that regard. Strong guys get muscle work. Pretty girls.
Whatever else we do, I said, we're closing that place down.
7.
The cell was a metal box and smelled of piss. The ginger-haired man opened the hatch and dragged Patience out. She tried to resist, but her limbs were weak and her mind muddy. The ginger-haired man still had his limiter off. His name was Darol, that much he had learned, and he worked for a man called Locketer.
On your feet, darling, Darol said. They're waiting for you.
He prodded her along the dim hallway. Patience didn't know where she was, but she knew it was at least a day since she had been taken from the Skolam by these men.
It's Patience, right?
The ginger-haired man said. Your trophy name.
My what?
Trophy name. The Skolam gives you all trophy names. Ready for the game. And yours is Patience, isn't it?
Where are my sisters? She asked.
Forget you ever had any. Locketer, the man in red, was waiting for them in a richly appointed salon at the end of the hallway. There were other men with him, all distinguished older males just like him, sitting around on couches and boy chairs, smoking low and sipping Amasek. Patience had seen their type so many times before at graduation suppers. Men of wealth and status, mill owners and merchants, shipmasters and guilders, and Patience had dreamed of the day when one of them would select her for service, employment, a future. How hollow that seemed now. For all their grooming, for all their fine clothes and fancy manners, these men were predators. The Skolam, which she had trusted for so long, had simply been their feeding ground.
Here she is, smiled Locketer. The men applauded lazily.
Still in her Skolam clothes,
a fat man in green said with relish.
A nice touch, Locketer.
I know you like them fresh, Boroth. Her name is Patience, and she is a telekine. I'm not sure if she realizes she is a telekine, actually. Do you, my dear? Do you know what you are?
Locketer addressed the last part of his question at her. Patience flushed.
I know what I am, she said. Trapped amongst a bunch of perverts, she said.
The men laughed.
Oh, such spirit, said Boroth.
And pretty green eyes, too,
said another man, swathed in orange furs.
The wager is 7,000 crowns per half-hour of survival, Locketer announced.
Very high, said the man in furs. What is the area, and the jeopardy?
Lo tenalt, replied Lockiter, and several of the men laughed.
Lo tenalt, Lockiter repeated, and the jeopardy is the dollars.
Although, if she's nimble, she might make it to Pennyraker territory, in which case the wager increases by another 150.
How many pawns? Asked a tall, bearded man in a Celpic blue doublet.
Standard rules, Vivian. One per player. Open choice. Body weapons only, although I'll allow a gun per pawn for jeopardy work. Guns are not to be used for taking the quarry, as I have no need to remind you. Gunshot death or disintegration voids the game, and the pot goes to the house.
Observation? Asked a thin man in grey robes.
Servo skull picta, as standard. House will supply 8. You'll each be allowed 2 of your own.
Will she be armed?
Boroth asked. I don't know. Would you care to choose a weapon? Lockiter asked Patience.
What is the game?
She replied. More laughter.
Life, of course, Lockiter said.
A weapon, Patience? The roll. Show her. The ginger-haired man walked over to a varnished hardwood case set on a side table, opened it, and revealed the numerous polished blades and exotic killing devices laid out on the velvet cushion.
"Choose, darling," he said.
Patience shook her head.
"I'm not a fighter. Not a killer."
"Darling, if you're going to live for even 10 minutes, you'll have to be both."
"I refuse," said Patience. "Frig you very much, darling."
The roll tutted and closed the case.
"Unarmed,"
Boroth said.
"I'll take the wager, Lockiter. In fact, I'll double you."
14 taken and offered, Lockiter announced.
Taken, said a man in pink suede.
I'm in, said the bearded man Lockiter had called Vevian. 4 of the others agreed too, opening money belts and casket bands, and tossing piles of cash on the low, dished table at Lockiter's feet. In 10 seconds there was 1,000 times more money in that baize bowl than Patience had ever even imagined.
Begin,
Lockiter said, rising to his feet. Pawns to the outer door for inspection and preparation. Drones will be scanned prior to release. I know your tricks, Boroth. Boroth chuckled and waved a pudgy hand. The game will commence in 30 minutes. Lockiter walked over to face Patience.
I have great faith in your abilities, Patience. Don't let me down. Don't lose me money.
She spat in his face. Lockiter smiled.
That's exactly what I was looking for.
The roll? The ginger-haired man grabbed Patience by the arms and marched her out of the room. They went down a maze of long brass tunnels, and finally up some iron steps into what seemed like a loading dock or an air gate.
Go stand by the doors, darling, he said.
What happens now?
Patience asked.
Now you run for your life until they get you,
the roll said. Patience put her hands against the rusted hatchway, and then pulled them away as the hatch rumbled open. She didn't know what to expect when she looked out. Beyond the hatchway, the shadowy wastes of the slum tracks stretched away into the distance.
I won't go out there, she growled.
Durrell came up behind her and shoved her outside. Patience fell into the dirt.
Word of advice, called the ginger-haired man. If you want it anyway. Watch for the dollars. They use the shadow. Don't trust black.
I don't,
Patience began. But the hatch slammed shut. Patience got to her feet. Gloom surrounded her. A hot, stinking wind blew in through the nearby ruins, smelling of garbage and city rot. Somewhere, something whooped gleefully in the darkness. A lifter rumbled overhead, its lights flashing. When she turned, she saw the immensity of the hive filling the sky behind her like a cliff, extending up as far as she could see. She started to run. 8. There was something wrong with Prefect Cyrus's face. A blush of burst blood vessels that even careful treatment with the Medicaid's dermo wand had failed to conceal. He was trying to be civil, and was clearly impressed by his visitor's apparel, but he was also put out.
This is irregular, I'm afraid,
he fussed as he led them into a waiting room where imperial teachings were writ in gold leaf on the dark wood panels.
There are appointed times for inspection, and also for apprenticeship dealings. Take a seat, won't you?
I apologize for the difficulties I'm causing, Carl replied, but time is rather pressing, and you came highly recommended.
I see, said Cyrus.
and I have resources to make it worth your while.
Indeed, smiled Cyrus.
And your name is?
I'd prefer not to deal in names, Carl smiled.
Then perhaps I should show you out, sir. This is a respectable academy.
Sitting cross-legged on the old couch, his fur-trimmed mantle turned back over his shoulder to expose the crimson falchepetta lining, Carl Thonius beckoned with one gloved hand to Kara, who stood waiting in the doorway. Kara was robed and cowed like some dumb servitor, and carried a heavy casket. As she approached, Carl leaned over and flipped the casket lid open.
Lutilium, 20 ingots, each of a weight of 1/8. I'll leave it to you to calculate the market price, Prefect.
Cyrus licked his lips slightly.
What is it you want, sir? 2 boys, 2 girls, no younger than 11, no older than 13. Healthy, fit, comely, clean. This is, I'm sorry, I'm being very direct, said Carl. I should have said this before. This is a matter of the most pleasant fraternal confidence.
I see, said Cyrus. Carl had just used one of the Cognite's private recognition codes, by which one graduate knew another.
I'll just see what's taking those refreshments so long to arrive.
The prefect bustled out of the room and hurried down a gloomy hallway to where Ide was waiting.
Bring the others in, Cyrus whispered to him. Do it quickly. If this is on the level, we look to earn well. But I have a feeling.
Ide nodded. In the waiting room, Carl sat back and winked at Kara.
The prefect's suspicious.
Really? Carl said softly. And I thought I was bringing such veracity to the part.
Get ready. Nail?
Harlan Nail grunted as he drove another crampon to the crumbling outer brick of the tower's side, and played out his line to bring him closer to a 9th-floor window. A terrible updraft from the stack chasm below tugged at his clothing.
Ready enough, he replied.
Harlan's in position. Carl, you can do the honors.
Thank you, sir, he whispered. It'll be a pleasure.
Cyrus came back into the room, smiling broadly.
Caffeine and cusp cake is just on its way. The cake is very fine, very gingery.
I can't wait, Carl said.
They're closing in. 4 now arriving at the west door, 3 on the stairs behind Kara, 2 more approaching from the floor above, all ex-guard, armed with batons, and I read at least 1 firearm.
Carl rose to his feet.
Oh, Prefect, there is 1 other thing I did want to say.
And that is? Asked Cyrus. Carl smiled his toothiest smile.
In the name of the Holy Inquisition, you motherless wretch, surrender now.
Cyrus gasped and began to back away.
Ide,
he screamed. Kara hurled the casket, and it slammed into Cyrus's midsection, felling him hard. He grunted in pain, and several of the heavy ingots scattered across the floor.
Move!
Kara threw off her drab robe and flew forwards as the first rigorist came in through the doorway. Guns were forbidden in the Skolam, but that didn't prevent this man from carrying one. Weapon scanners around the entry gate screened visitors for firearms, but lutilium, apart from its monetary worth, had value as a substance opaque to scanners. Rigorist Ide raised his handgun as he came in. Kara, on her knees, reached into the fallen casket and produced a transvasa compact hidden between the layers of ingots.
"Surprise!" she said, and buried a caseless round in his forehead.
The rear part of Ide's skull burst like a squeezed pimple, and he fell on his back. She got up, shot the sprawled Cyrus once through the back of the thigh to make sure he wasn't going anywhere, and swung to face the door. The next 2 rigorists burst in on Ide's heels, batons raised, and she shot out their knees. Thonius winced and covered his ears. In the hall outside, the other rigorists backed in terror from the sound of gunfire. Then a shaped charge blew out the casement behind them in a blizzard of glass and leading, and Harlan Nail swung into the hallway. He had a large automatic pistol in his left fist.
"Any takers?" he asked.
One ran, and Nail shot him through the heel. The others sank to their knees, hands to their heads.
"Good lads," Nail said.
He took a neural disruptor from his belt in his right hand and walked over to them. cracking each one comatose with a fierce zap from the blunt device. In the waiting room, the air threaded with gun smoke, Kara turned to face the opposite doors as other alerted rigorists crashed in from the stairs. Nil led them, and didn't even blink at the sight of the small woman with the handgun. He flew at her. "Ninka!" she complained, and shot him. The round penetrated his torso, and didn't slow him. He crashed into her and knocked her flat. Suzerain and another rigorist named Fuick were right behind Nil. Fuick knocked Karl over with a blow from his baton, and Suzerain raised the battered bolt pistol that he'd carried since his days in the commissariat. He fired at Kara, but managed only to blow off Nil's left foot and his left arm at the elbow. Nail appeared at the opposite door and yelled a warning that Suzerain answered by lifting his aim and blasting at the doorway. Brick chips and wooden splinters exploded from the jam. Kara reached out from under Nil's dead weight and shot Suzerain up through the chin. The rigorist left the ground for a moment, then crashed back down dead. Nail reappeared and put a round through Fuick's back as he turned to flee. Nail helped Kara out from under the half-dead brute.
"Nobody helped me up then," Karl complained.
Panic had seized the Skolem. I could feel it, breathe it. Hundreds of children and young adults terrified by the explosions and gunshots. And a deeper panic, a deeper dread, that emanated from the minds of the rigorists and tutors. I hovered towards the main gate, Whiston at my side, and ripped the ancient doors off their hinges with a brisk nudge of my mind. Inside the entranceway, half a dozen tutors and rigorists were running towards us, hoping for a speedy exit.
"I am Inquisitor Ravener of the Holy Ordos. Remain where you are."
I don't think they understood the manner of the command, though several involuntarily defecated in fear as the telepathic burst hit them. All they saw was a lone man approaching beside a strange, covered chair.
"Now!"
My psi wave threw them all backwards violently, like the pressure blast of a hurricane. Windows shattered. They tumbled over, robes shredding, flying like dolls or desperately trying to grip onto the floor. Whiston lit a low stick. "What I like about you," he said, "is that you don't muck around."
"Thank you."
I had switched a voxponder, and now I activated my built-in voxcaster. "This is Ravener to Magistratum Fairwing. Your officers may now move in and secure the building as instructed."
"Yes, Inquisitor."
"Do not harm any of the children." 9. I had expected to find many things within the Skolem. Evidence of abuse and cruelty, certainly. Damaged souls. Perhaps even answers, if I was lucky. I had not expected to find traces of psyker activity.
"What's the matter?" Kara asked me.
"I'm not sure."
We moved down the long hallways, past the frightened faces of pupils, herded along by the magistratum officers, past whimpering tutors, spread against the old walls as they were patted down for concealed weapons. The traces were slight, ephemeral, fading, like strands of gossamer clinging to the brickwork. But they were there.
"There was a psyker here."
Kara stiffened.
"Relax. No, I believe it was a she. She's not here anymore. But she was here for a long time, and she left only recently."
"When you say a long time, you mean?"
"Years."
"And when you say recently?"
"Days. Maybe less."
We explored the tower. For Kara, this was a curious process. She could not see or feel, taste or smell the traces that were so evident to me. She just followed me around, one empty room after another. I could sense her boredom and her frustration. She wanted to be with the others, active, rounding up the last of the Skolam's inhabitants. "Sorry, this must be tedious for you," I said.
"It's fine," she replied. "Take your time. I can be patient. Patience is a virtue."
"Indeed." We entered a large dining hall in the upper reaches of the tower. The traces were strongest and freshest there.
"Telekine," I said. "I'm in no doubt. A telekine, raw but potentially strong."
"We have to find her," Kara said.
"If this damn place really was grooming subjects for the Cognite, she could be a lead. A direct connection to a Cognite procurer."
Kara was right. Among their many crimes, the Cognite prided themselves on recruiting and retaining unlicensed psykers for their own purposes.
"Go and find Karl for me, Kara," I requested.
I want to get him here. I want to get him working on discovering who this psycho was and where she might have gone.
Because of the cognitive link?
She nodded. Yes, because of that, I replied. But even if no link exists, we still have to find her. An unsanctioned psyker, loose on Sameter, that cannot be permitted. We must track her down and dispose of her. 10.
I'm sorry, Carl Thurnius said. Sir, I'm very sorry.
The device was very small, no larger than a hearing aid implant.
I should have searched him right there, but with all the shooting and screaming.
Don't worry about it, Carl, I said.
I think I will, sir. Everything's blanked.
The device was a trigger switch, coded to Cyrus's thumbprint. An advanced piece of tech. Down on the floor, helpless from the wound Kara had delivered to his leg, Cyrus had plucked this device from his pocket and activated it. And the Skolam's entire data archive had been erased. Can you recover anything? I asked.
It's a fairly comprehensive wipe. I might be able to recode the last few days' worth of material.
The stuff most recently processed might still exist in the codification buffer. Do what you can, I advised. Privately, I was annoyed with his lapse. But we had, with the assistance of local law enforcement, rounded up dozens of tutors and Skolam elders, including Cyrus himself. And who could say what the poor pupils themselves might be able to tell us? Besides, it was hardly surprising. Carl was so poor in circumstances of violence. I don't believe he had ever fired a shot in anger, though he performed well enough in weapons drill.
I'll get to work, sir,
Carl said.
I'm so very sorry.
So you bloody should be.
Nail snorted. Enough, Harlan, I rebuked. Carl is my interrogator, and you will address him with respect.
I'll do that, Nail replied, when he earns it.
Do what you can, Carl, I said. But remember, your priority is to find out all there is to know about the unsanctioned psyker they had here. Who she was, where she went. She has to be found and dealt with quickly.
Yes, sir.
As Carl moved away, the senior magistratum approached. His enforcement officers, clad in black and silver, were still clearing the Skolam, floor by floor. I could sense his unease. He was an experienced criminologist, but he'd never had his entire station house requisitioned to assist the Inquisition before. He was terrified of screwing up. He was terrified of me. Problems? I asked.
A few scuffles, sir. You'd rather taken the wind out of their sails.
I want all the children to be given medical checks, and then safe-housed until statements can be taken from them all. Inform the administratum that welfare assistance will be required, but not yet. No one is to be rehoused or rehomed unless they've been examined. Why do you frown? The magistratum started a little.
There are over 900 children, sir, he began.
Improvise. Ask the local temples for alms and shelter.
Yes, sir. May I ask, is this an abuse case, sir?
Indirectly. I can't say more. The staff I'll interview here, now. I'll need some of your men to assist in guarding them while the interrogations are underway. Once I'm done, I will file charges, and you can begin to process them.
Yes, sir.
I'll start with the prefect. A magistratum first aider had patched Cyrus's leg wound, and they'd shackled him to a chair in one of the refectories. He was in pain and very frightened, which would make it easier to extract information. Cyrus stared at me as I rolled in to face him. Nail followed me in, but sat his ominous bulk down at the far end of the long table from Cyrus, a threat waiting to happen.
I have rights, Cyrus began. In the eyes of Imperial law, I have...
Nothing. You are a prisoner of the Inquisition. Do not ask for or expect anything.
Then I'll tell you nothing.
Again, you are mistaken. You will tell me everything I ask you to tell me. Harlan. From the far end of the table, Nail began to speak.
His name is Ludovic Cairo. Cognite trained, wanted on 5 worlds for counts of heresy and sedition.
Cyrus closed his eyes as the words came out. We already knew his true identity. What else did we have? Tell me about Victor Zahn. Cyrus frowned.
I don't know of Victor Zahn.
I was watching his mind.
It wasn't the truth, but it wasn't an outright lie either. Cyrus didn't immediately recognize the name.
Tell me about Victor Zahn.
Cyrus blinked as the telepathy slapped him. My interrogative was accompanied by an image of Zahn's corpse in the Hinterlights morgue, which I dropped into his mind like a slide into a magic lantern.
Oh, Throne,
he murmured.
You know him, then?
He was a pupil here, years ago.
And Goodman Frell? And Noble Soto?
Two more graphic images.
Oh, holy! They were pupils, too. This was years ago. Five or more.
And you groomed them, said Nail. You and your staff. Groom them like you groom all the poor strays who wind up here. Sold them on.
No, this is a respectable place and—
So respectable, I said, that you wipe all your records so we can't see them. Cyrus bit his lip. Zahn, Frell, Soto.
Who did you sell them to?
To a merchant, as I remember.
Lie. Bald and heavy. And well formed, not just vocally, but mentally, too. A layer of mendacity cloaked Cyrus's thoughts, like a cake of dried mud. A mind trick, one of the many taught by the Cognitae. I had been expecting as much. For all his fear, Cyrus was still a product of that heretical institution, and therefore had to be unlocked with precision. If I'd just burst into his mind telepathically from the outset, I might have damaged or destroyed many of his locked engrams. But now I had a solid lie out of him, and that lie revealed the way his mind shields worked, their focus, their strengths, their inclination.
Who did you sell them to?
I told you, a merchant, a free trader.
Who?
He squealed as the psi-jab rattled his mind. He was utterly unprepared for the sharpness of it.
That was a demonstration of how things will be if you resist, I said. Now, I'm going to ask the question once more.
11. Patience heard the buzzing, not with her ears, but with her mind, and slid into cover behind a crumbling rock-crete wall. Moments later, a varnished human skull hovered past through the gloom. Tech implants decorated the back of its cranium, and lights shone in its hollow orbits. A sensor drone sweeping for her. She'd heard the bastards talking about them before her release. This was the first physical proof that men were actually after her. Men. Hunters. Killers. The skull hovered on the spot for a moment, circled once, and then sped away into the shadows. Patience stayed low. After another minute, a second drone, this one built around the skull of a dog or a cat, skimmed past and made off in another direction. She slowed her breathing and deliberately encouraged her mind to do the sort of tricks that usually happened unbidden. She reached out. She could feel the area around her in a radius of 10 meters. 40. 60. The shape of the geography, the sloping trench to her left, the broken columns ahead, the line of burnt-out habs to her right. Behind her, the sewer outfall pouring sludge into a cracked storm drain. She sensed bright sparks of mental energy, but they were just rats scuttling in the ruins. Then she sensed one that wasn't. This spark was bigger, human, very controlled and intense. Right ahead, beyond the columns, moving forward. Moving slowly, so as not to dislodge any loose stones, she turned and began to creep away around the storm drain chute, towards a jumble of plasteel ruins. Her left toe kicked a rock, and it rolled away off the drain's edge and started to fall. Patience caught it neatly with her mind and lifted it up into the silence of her hand. The brief delay had been to her advantage. Now she sensed three or four human mind traces in the ruins ahead of her. Not focused like the other one. Feral. In the shadows. Don't trust the black. That's what Darol had said to her. Trouble was, could she trust Darol's advice? She crouched low and stayed there until she could see them. Ragged human shapes, barely visible, moving like animals through the ruins. Gangers, members of the notorious Dolor clan. She could see three, but was sure there were more. The hunter was closing from the right, now almost at the rock-crete wall. Patience lifted the rock in her hand and threw it, sending it far further than her arm alone could have managed. It landed in the trench with a loud clatter. The hunter turned and made for it immediately. She got a glimpse of a man in an armored jack and high boots, scurrying towards the lip of the trench. Then the Dolors saw him too. A pivot gun roared, and the hunter was knocked off his feet. The gangers rushed forwards at once, baying and yelling, crude blade weapons flashing in their dirty hands. The hunter's jack had stopped the worst of the ball round. He leapt back up and shot the closest Dolor through the neck with his handgun. The savage figure spasmed and went down thrashing. Then the others cannoned into the hunter, and they all went over into the trench. Patience started to run. She heard another shot behind her. A scream. She scrambled over a rusted length of vent ducting and dropped into the cavity of a roofless hab, where a man was waiting for her. Patience gasped. There had been no spark off him at all. Either he was shielded, or his mind just did not register to her gift like regular human minds. He was tall and thin, clothed head to foot in a matte black, skin-tight bodysuit. Only his eyes were visible through a slit in the tight mask, but she saw the way the fabric beneath them stretched to betray the smile that had just crossed his face. He held a long, slender spike knife in each hand. Patience stretched out with her mind, hoping to push him away, but the tendrils of her gift slipped off his black suit, unable to purchase. He lunged at her, the twin blades extended, and she was forced to dive sideways, grazing her palms and knees on the rough ground. She started to roll, but he was on her at once, the tip of one blade slicing through the flesh of her left shoulder. Patience cried out, but the pain gave her strength. She kicked out, and as the man jumped back, she flipped onto her feet. She backed as he circled again. She could hear him chuckle, feel the blood running down her arm. He lunged again, leading with his right-hand blade. She ducked it and came out under his arm, but the other blade raked across the back of her right hand as she tried to fend him off. She punched at him. He struck her in the side of the head with the ball of his right hand and knocked her onto the ground. There was a rushing sound in her head. She thought of her sisters and the mother she could no longer picture. In desperation, she lashed out with her gift, but the killer's black skin suit again rendered him proof against her power. It was too slippery. She couldn't get hold of anything except... The man stumbled backwards in surprise as the knives flew out of his hands. He might have been armored against a telekine, head to toe, but his blades were good, old-fashioned, solid objects. Patience pulled them both in until they were slowly orbiting her body as she rose. It would be the matter of a moment to toss them both away out of the hunter's reach. But she had a much better idea. With a bark of effort, she drove them point first towards his eye slit and nailed his skull against the back wall of the hab. 12. Carl Thonius knocked on the refectory door and waited for a response. From inside, the oddly modulated screams and yelps of Prefect Cyrus shivered the air. As he waited, Carl glanced around at the four magistratum troopers guarding the hallway. They were clearly unnerved by the strange sounds of human pain echoing from the refectory. Carl smiled breezily, but got no response. He knocked again. The screams ebbed for a moment, and the door flew open. Nail peered out.
"What?" he spat.
"I need a word, dear fellow, with the boss."
"Don't dear fellow me, Frigface. Is this important? He's busy."
"Well..."
Carl stammered. He was always edgy when he had to deal with the big ex-bounty hunter.
"It is, sort of."
Nail sneered.
"Sort of doesn't cut it."
He slammed the door in Carl's face. Carl cursed and knocked again. Nail threw the door back open.
"Don't do that," Carl snapped. "Don't treat me like that."
"Oh, go away, you frigwipe."
Carl looked Nail in the eyes.
"Know your place, Nail. You may not like me, but I am his interrogator. I want to see him now."
Nail looked Thonius up and down.
"Balls, after all," he said, grudgingly. "All right."
Carl walked into the room. Cyrus was slumped forwards in his chains, wheezing, blood leaking from his tear ducts. Kara sat on a chair just inside the door, her face grim.
"Carl," I said softly, "this isn't really the time for an interruption."
"Sir, I've been trying to recover the lost data, the erased data. There's really not much to get back, I'm afraid. I doubt we'll ever find out what happened to most of the poor children laundered through this place."
"Your incompetence could have waited," Nail said.
"Stop ragging on him, Nail," Kara hissed.
Carl shot Nail a dark look. I could tell there was something more.
I told you I might be able to recode the last few days' worth of material. Recently processed material still existing in the codification buffer.
Yes, Carl.
He cleared his throat. There was one item there, a record of a transaction made 2 nights ago. An older female pupil named Patience, groomed by these bastards partly because of her spirit, and mostly because she was a latent telekine.
I swung around to face him. Are you sure?
Yes, sir.
A telekine.
He nodded. The recoding is pretty clear. I think she was the psyker you were looking for.
Did you say her name was Patience?
Kara asked quietly.
Yes. Why?
Carl replied. She shrugged. She was holding something back.
Kara, I nudged.
It's nothing, she said. Just when you were looking around for traces of her, you thought I was bored, and I said...
Patience is a virtue, I finished.
Kara nodded.
Yeah, patience is a virtue. Spooky.
Coincidence,
Nail muttered.
Believe me, Harlan, I said. In the length and breadth of this great imperium of man, there is no such thing as coincidence. Not where psych is involved.
Duly noted, he replied,
not caring or believing.
Where did this Patience go, Carl? I asked.
She was sold for 10,000 to a narco-baron cartel that purchased her for use in a game they like to play.
A game?
I asked. The record implies this is not the first subject the Skolam has sold to the cartel for this purpose. I say game, it's more sport. They release the purchased child into the slum tracks, and then they gamble on how long he or she will survive, once they send their hunters out.
So what? Asked Nail. They'll clean up our little psych witch loose end without us having to break a sweat.
If the records are true, I warned. Consider this. There might be a game. There might be a narco-baron with a taste for barbaric gladiatorial sport. On the other hand, all those things might be a substitution code to conceal an act of purchase to a cognite procurer.
I actually don't know which would be worse, Kara said.
I turned back to Cyrus. He whined as my mind re-entered his. He was still weak and reeling from our initial session. And by rights, I should have left him for a while to be sure of getting accurate responses. But there was no time. An unsanctioned menace was loose somewhere, or already leaving the planet under close watch. I tried a few key phrases. The psyker. The telekine. Patience. Pushing them at his mind in the way a child rams shaped blocks at a box, hoping to find the right hole to fit. He responded with various recurring words. Locator. The game. Trophy worth.
I wasn't sure how hard to push. I wasn't sure if I was slamming him back against the limits of truth, where there is nowhere left for sanity to go, or simply meeting some form of substitution. Substitution was another standard cognite mind ploy. Anticipating psychic interrogation, the Brotherhood mnemonically learned to replace the details of true memories with engrammatic euphemisms. Narco-baron, for example, could stand for procurer. Game might stand for purpose. It was a simple but almost unbreakable deceit. Well-schooled, a cognite brother could mask memories with metaphors. He could not be caught in a lie, because he wasn't lying. The truth had been erased and replaced with other facts. Using such techniques, a member of the Brotherhood might withstand the most serious psych scrutiny, because the truth was no longer there to uncover. "He's giving me nothing," I cursed, turning away, "unless it is the truth."
"Do you have an active lead, Carl?"
Thonius nodded.
Kara got to her feet.
"Let's go and find her," she said. "If the story's real, I mean, if there is this frigging barbaric game actually going on, there's a girl out there who really, really needs help right now."
"Throne, let her die," Nail barked. "Friggin' psyker." "What? What?"
Kara and Thonius were already heading for the door.
"One life, Harlan," I said as I slid past him. I learned many things from Eisenhorn, but ruthlessness was not one of them. Thousands may die, millions even, unless Moloch is found and brought to justice. But any count of a million starts with one, and to ignore one life when there is still a chance of saving it, well, one might as well give up on the other 999,999 as well.
"Whatever," said Nail.
"Thank you for your vote of confidence," I said. "Kara, inform the magistratum that these interviews are suspended until we return."
Playing Patience. 13. The armored manse did indeed belong to the man named Lockiter, and 19 counts of narco-traffic were outstanding on his name. The manse was a brass mushroom that dominated a long slope of rubble scree above the shadowland of the slum tracts. Down here, with the monolithic bulk of Urbitane behind us, the immensity of the urban squalor and ruin was shocking to see. The manse was ferro-armored and shielded, but our scanners lit with the buzz of electromag activity inside. "Signals," Kara reported. "They're running drones out into the slums."
"Can you track them?" I asked.
"Working." She adjusts some dials. "I've got a lock on 9, covering a hex grid 12x10. Map comparison." "Thrawn, these archives are so old. Here we go. An area known as Low Tenelt."
"Details."
"Serious slumland," Carl said, speed viewing the data on his codifier. "Basically wreckage. High probability of gang activity. Territorially, the gangs are the Dolors, and to the west, the ruined burbs are run by the so-called Penny Rakers. Magistratum advice is to avoid this area."
"Really?"
Carl shrugged. "Magistratum advice is a blanket. Avoid the slum tracts. So, what the hay?"
"How far?" I asked.
At the helm of the cargo gig, Nail consulted the gyro nav built into the stick.
8 spans to the Low Tenelt area from here. On boost."
"Do it," I said.
"You don't want to level this manse first?"
Nail asked.
"They can wait. This girl can't."
Nail nodded reluctantly and hit the boosters. He wasn't in this like the rest of us were. Running low, like a pond fly, skating the surface, we zipped through the ruined landscape, skipping rubble heaps, ducking under shattered transit bridges, running fast and low along the brick-waste gouges that had once been Hab streets. Everything was a grey gloom, caught in the immense shadow of the city. Such ruin, such endless ruin.
"Coming up, 0.3,
reported Nail, hauling on the stick. The engines whined shrill.
2, 1, setting down."
The gig thumped and slithered as it settled on the loose brick. Carl, Nail, and Kara were already up, arming weapons.
"Sit down, Carl," I said. "I need you to run scope from here."
"Oh," he said.
"I want full scanner input," I said, as I hovered towards the opening hatch behind Kara and Harlan. "Whiston can watch your back."
"You're going yourself?" Whiston asked, surprised. It was one of the few times I'd ever heard emotion in his voice.
"Yes," I said.
Kara and Harlan looked at me.
"Yes, I'm coming with you," I said.
"Have you got a problem with that?"
"It's just..." Kara began.
"You don't usually..."
Nail finished.
"This isn't usually,"
I said, and powered out past them into the chilly gloom. Nail leapt out after me, his Urdeshi-made assault gun cinched high around his broad frame. Kara paused and looked back at Whiston and Thonius.
"Lock the door," she grinned, "and don't open it unless you know it's us. Even then, keep your powder dry."
She jumped out, raised her Manumit 90 riot gun, and ran to join us. Carl swallowed. Whiston Frauker got up and locked the hatch shut. He looked at Carl, lit yet another low stick, and patted the handgun tucked into his belt.
"I got your back, Carly," he said.
"Great," said Thonius.
He turned to regard the sweeping screens of the scanner and adjusted his vox mic.
"Getting this?"
he called.
"Loud and obnoxiously clear,"
Nail crackled back.
"Ah, ha, ha. Funny. Not. Move west, 200 meters, then head north along the axis of the old fuel store. The drones seem to be gathering there."
"Thank you, Carl," I responded.
We moved through the wasteland. It was one of the few times my state allowed me speedier and quieter access than my able-bodied friends. Nail and Kara followed, clambering over the dunes of rubble.
"See anything you like?" Kara said.
"I don't frigging believe we're doing this,"
Nail grumbled.
"Move left, left!"
Carl's voice rasped over the vox.
"I've got drones moving now. Gunshots!"
"I heard them,"
Nail said, and started away to the left. "Flank him wide, Kara," I said, and she moved away in the opposite direction.
"Thrawn,"
I heard Carl say. I think we were right. I think this is some kind of frigging game.
I propelled myself forwards. Both Kara and Harlan were out of sight now, though I could sense them just 50 meters away, each side of me. The twisted ruins of the tracts rose up on left and right. I tasted life signs.
Hello, I transponded.
The Dolors appeared out of the gloom, ragged, emaciated, filthy, feral. There were 20 of them. Blackened teeth bared in wild grins, they raised their cudgels and spears and charged.
Your mistake, I said.
14. The barons were laughing. Most of them were drunk, or out of their heads on Lotus and Obscura. Darol looked up from the drone relay.
Have we got the bitch yet?
Boroth demanded. You wish, Darol said. He walked across the lounge and crouched down beside Lockiter.
What? Asked the man in red. New players just entered the game, Darol said.
Lockiter sat up. Show me. Darol held out his data slate.
3 on the ground. A gig too. Grounded there.
What the hell is this? Problem, Lockiter? Asked Vevian. Lockiter rose and smiled. Not a problem, but a bonus element to our game today. Look at your scans. See? Newcomers.
Who the frig are they?
Gedinsky blurted. Interlopers, Lockiter said. House will pay 2,000 for each one killed. Firearms permitted. The intoxicated crowd applauded this energetically. Lockiter looked at Darol.
The ones on the ground I can get these fools to mess with, he whispered. You go and fry up this gig.
Yeah?
Yeah. Find out who these fools are. Then burn it and everyone on it.
Darol nodded. Pleasure, he said. 15. Patience was still running. The Dolors, invisible in the shadows but everywhere now, were jeering and caterwauling, their strangled cries echoing around the ragged walls and shattered windows. They were calling out to her, taunting her, abusing her with obscene words and suggestions, many of which, thankfully, were so choked up by the gang argo they made no sense. Occasionally, stones or pieces of trash came flying out of the darkness at her, and she deflected all those she could. Some found her, especially the stinging stone bullets launched from catapults and slings. Her instinct was to head back towards the colossal city, but no matter how much ground she managed to cover, it seemed not to get any closer. Its sheer scale made the distance hard to judge. It was probably kilometers away still. She reached the ruins of a manufactory, its ply steel roof collapsed. Seas of garbage and rubble spread out from its eastern side, and she began to pick her way across the weed-choked waste. Behind her she could hear the gangers scurrying through the manufactory ruins. A few missiles flew out after her. A figure suddenly appeared ahead of her, across the sea of trash. A small male, or perhaps a female, who'd been in cover behind the remains of a yard wall, hidden by a chameleon cloak. Glancing up, Patience cursed as she saw a hunter drone that had obviously been shadowing her for several minutes. Patience changed course and began to run away from the figure. She ran wide across the overgrown trash. The figure started to follow, trying to cut her off, running hard, but neither made particularly good going. The trash and rubble was so uneven, so treacherous. Patience kept tripping, stumbling, turning her ankles. As soon as the hunter appeared, the jeering from the invisible Dolors grew more ferocious. Catapult missiles and even the occasional arrow whipped out from the manufactory at the hunter. The hunter, and it was clearly a female, stopped in her tracks and produced an auto pistol. She slammed in a clip and fired 3 times at the manufactory. The shells must have been high X, because each impact went up like a grenade. Sections of the manufactory ruin blew in, and the Dolors went very quiet suddenly. Patience was still running. The hunter put the gun away and resumed the chase. A second drone zoomed into view suddenly, circled Patience once, and then headed for the hunter. The woman stopped again, looking around frantically as she reached for her sidearm. Patience half heard her shout a question into her vox set. There was a loud crack, a peripheral flash of light, and the female hunter jolted suddenly as a las round went clean through her torso. She crumpled without a sound. Her killer appeared, directly ahead of Patience. She skidded to a halt. He was big, and wore segmented plating over a coat of green hide. A glowing augmetic implant covered one eye. He had a las carbine in his hands. He stared at Patience for a moment, then put the carbine away in the leather boot over his shoulders. Then he drew a large dagger with a twisted black blade and took a step towards her.
"Make it easy now, and I promise you won't feel nothing," he said.
Patience was breathing hard from the running. It made it easier somehow to summon up her gift. The man thought the first couple of stones that came flying at him were from the gangers, but then more came, and more, larger rocks, pieces of trash, chunks of garbage. Debris started showering off the ground all around her, whipping at him. He cried out, shielding his face with his hands, and backed away. She heard him cry again, in pain, as a greasy lump of broken-off machinery hit him in the chest. He staggered, trying to fend the blizzard away. Then a piece of cinder block caromed off the side of his head, and he fell to his knees, holding his head. Two more large rocks struck his face and forehead, and he slumped over entirely. Patience sighed, and the rain of trash subsided, pieces bouncing off the ground as they landed. Silence. She gave the body one last look and started to run again. Behind her, in the manufactory, and all along the outer fence line, the invisible gangers started to whoop and holler again. 16. I had just seen off a second assault by the slum gangers when I felt the telekinetic burst. Fierce, unfocused, not too far away. "Turn west," I voxed.
"Understood," Kara responded.
"I read that," said Nail. "I just heard bolter fire from that direction, too."
I slid through the ruins, my mind wide open. There were side traces all around me, at least a dozen as close as 50 meters. Most were the feral impulses of the hidden dollars, but there, one other, harder. Two las rounds struck the front of my chair and fizzled off harmlessly. I found the hunter as he was about to fire again, and picked him up. He yelled in fear as he left the ground, dragged into the air 10 meters, 20. Then I let him go. I didn't even bother to watch him land. The sharp light of his mind went out abruptly.
"I heard shots," Kara voxed. "Are you all right?"
"Fine," I replied. "Kara, it is a game, an obscene hunting game. We have to find this girl, whatever she is, before they do."
"Understood, absolutely."
Kara was about a third of a kilometer away to my right.
"I've got a drone active in your vicinity," Carl told her over the link.
Kara acknowledged and glanced around. That was when the two hunters, twins clad in silver-gray skin sleeves, pounced. One pinned her arms from behind, the other came at her with a chain fist. She rolled her body back, using the man pinning her as a back brace, and bicycle kicked the other in the face. He went over in the rubble, rolling. But the man pinning Kara from behind rammed forwards and headbutted her in the back of the skull.
"Kara!"
Even at that distance, I felt her pain, and sensed that she had blacked out. They'd have gutted her before she could come round. I knew I had no choice. I had to wear her. It wasn't something she or anyone else I knew enjoyed, but it was necessary. Besides, we had trained for this. Kara Swole was a particularly receptive candidate. The wraithbone pendant around her neck lit up with psychic energy. Kara's body suddenly animated again, but it was me moving her. I had taken her physical form over, put it on like a suit of clothes. Blank-eyed, Kara's body twisted hard and broke the pinning hold. She tore clear, landed well, and swept out the legs of the hunter with the chain fist so he went over on his backside. Then she turned, raising a forearm block against the other's attack, following the block with two rapid jabs to his face and a side stamp that caught and dislocated his right knee. He howled in pain. Kara, stroke I, grabbed his flailing arms and swung him bodily around right into his partner, who was returning to the fight for the second time. The partner's forward thrust chain fist, which had been sweeping at Kara stroke me, met the ribs of his fellow hunter instead. The whirring bite blades of the gauntlet weapon punched clean through the man's side in a shocking welter of blood and torn tissue. He screamed as he died, his whole body quivering in time to the rending vibrations of the glove's cycling blades. His partner and accidental killer screamed too, in outrage and horror at what he had just done. He wrenched the glove out, but it was too late. His twin, a huge and awful evacuation yawning in the side of his torso, stopped quivering and dropped. A film of blood covered everything in a 5-meter radius. berserk, the remaining hunter hurled himself at Kara, stroke me. We leapt, boosted by a touch of telekinesis, and executed a perfect somersault over his head. He swung around, but by then Kara, stroke I, had grabbed up her fallen riot gun. Her puppet hand racked the slide. A single booming shot blew the hunter backwards 8 meters. We heard a sound behind us and turned, bringing the pump gun up.
Steady,
Nail warned.
What are you doing here?
Kara stroke I demanded.
You were in trouble, Kara, he said. I heard it over the vox. I came as fast as I could.
What about the girl? What about the girl we're looking for?
Nail shrugged.
Kara?
No, it's me, damn it, I said with Kara's voice. Catch her for throne's sake. I'm coming out.
Nail hurried forwards and took Kara's limp form into his arms as I ceased wearing her. She was semi-conscious, and the trauma of being a were-subject would leave her disorientated and sick for a good while.
Guard her, Harlan. In fact, get her back to the transport.
Where are you going?
He asked the empty air.
To find the girl.
17. Closed back into the womb-like nowhere of my support chair, I impelled it forwards again, trying to reacquire the raw psychic pulse I'd felt before. I felt edgy. Having to wear someone was a curious thing to deal with, and the feelings always left me conflicted. I was aware that the subject loathed the sensation, and it was also most usually done in moments of extremis, involving violence and furious levels of adrenaline. But for me it was a brief, delicious escape, a cruel reminder of what I had lost. I despised myself for deriving pleasure from such painful, demeaning moments.
Carl.
Yes, sir.
Do you have a fix on me?
Yes, sir. I've got 2 more drone tracks about 0.5 kilometer ahead, converging. Please hurry, sir.
I'm hurrying.
Back in the gig, Carl looked up from his scanner displays, fidgeting with his cuffs nervously. He looked at Whiston, who was reading his data slate again.
Don't you care? Carl asked.
The Untouchable nodded at his book.
It's just getting interesting.
Outside, Darol scurried forward, keeping low behind a half-fallen wall. He checked the area, unshipped his las pistol, and deactivated his limiter. Then he began to run, head down, towards the parked transport. 18. Her breathing was coming in short, sharp bursts. Patience had run as hard and as fast as she could. There was at least one person very close to her now, but the psychic trace was faint and hard to place. She was worn out, exhausted, and her gift was weak from overuse. She clambered down into a cavity behind a ruined pumping station, crawling into a cave formed by the overhang of the fallen roof. She curled up against the back wall, her arms around her knees. Outside, the Dolors were still jeering and shouting, but it was more distant now. She'd gone as far as she could. Now it was just a matter of waiting. Waiting for the end.
Patience.
She started and looked around, not daring to speak.
Patience. Stay calm. Stay where you are. I'm coming to help you. I want to help you.
Where are you?
She hissed in fear.
Don't speak. They'll hear you. Think your answers.
What do you mean? Where the frig are you?
Don't be scared. Try not to speak aloud. They'll hear you.
This is another trick. You're one of them. One of the frigging hunters.
No. Patience, my name is Gideon. I swear by the God Emperor himself I mean you no harm. I'm trying to help you. You're hearing me because I am speaking directly to your mind, psychically.
You lie.
Try me. Think of something I couldn't know.
Patience closed her eyes and moaned softly.
Prudence and Prudence.
She gasped.
Your sisters. You're worried about them. They were taken. Wait. Yes, they were taken from the Skolam. Without your consent.
Just kill me, you bastard, or leave me alone.
Please, Patience, don't speak. They'll hear you.
I was moving fast now. The jagged ruins of the slum tracks slid by me on either side. Rocks and catapult bullets occasionally clattered off my chair's armor. Where was she? Where was she?
Patience, can you still hear me?
Leave me alone,
she sobbed,
crawling deeper into the damp cavity.
"I can't do this. I can't do this any more."
"Yes, you can. Just keep it together. Focus. Focus on something."
Patience twisted in panic, clawing at the sides of her head. I was scaring her. My voice. Something about my voice. Not just the fact that it was coming, disembodied into her mind. Something else. What? As I steered my chair out across a long sea of trash and debris, I gently peered into her mind, into the panic and turmoil, into the fear. I saw it. It was my voice itself. I sounded like a middle-aged, well-educated male, reasonable, polite, refined, exactly the sort of man who had betrayed her for her entire life, her fellow pupils, her sisters. I saw she had formed a picture of me already. It was part Cyrus, part Ide, part Locketer, part some ginger-haired man. It was all of these, blended into one monster. Immediately, I switched the focus of my telepathy.
Kara.
I found her at once, bleary and sick. Nail was helping her along a rubble ledge, back towards the gig.
What?
She asked.
I'm sorry, Kara, but I need to wear you again.
Throne, no,
she whimpered.
She's had enough, boss,
Nail said.
It's important, really important. I need her voice.
Kara looked at Nail and nodded wearily. He caught her as her wraithbone pendant flashed, and she fell. I left her body limp in Nail's arms and put on her personality like a skin suit. My psychic voice became Kara Swole's soft, reassuring tones.
Patience.
What? What?
Patience, my name is Kara. My good friend Gideon has asked me to talk to you. Time is very short, Patience, and you need to listen to me if you want to stay alive. Trust Gideon. Do exactly as I say.
I could feel the girl giving way to panic.
Patience, focus. Hold on. There must be something you can hold on to. Something you can hold on to so you can keep going. Your sisters, maybe. Your mother. Patience.
She had found it at last. It was something so small and dark and hard in her mind that even my telepathy could not unlock it. She held on to it, tight, tight, as the dark closed in. Her panic waned. Her breathing slowed. I was close now. I could reach her. Patience opened her eyes. A skull, eyes bright, hovered at arm's reach in front of her, gazing at her.
A drone.
I was too late. She had made too much noise. The hunters had found her. 19.
Throne,
cried Carl, leaning back from his Auspex station in alarm.
What the hell did you do?
I might have broken wind, admitted Winston Frauker. Sorry. He turned back to his book.
Check your limiter, dear boy,
Thonius demanded.
Why?
Why? I was just listening in and Ravenna suddenly went offline. The Vox?
The Vox is still live. I mean his telepathic link just scrambled.
Was that you? Winston Frauker frowned and put down his data slate. He checked his device. No, it's on. I'm blocked.
Then what?
Relax, Carly. I'll take a look.
Please,
Carl began. Frauker patted the handgun in his belt again.
I told you, I've got your back. No, it's just... Could you not call me Carly?
Frauker frowned. All right. What about Thony, then?
No,
Frauker held up his hands.
All right, Throne. I was just being pally.
The boss said I was too aloof. Too aloof. Can you believe it? He suggested I should try being more friendly. He said it would help with team building, and...
Frigging hell, Frauker!
What?
Emperor's tits, you guys are so uptight. I'll go look, I'll go look. I got your back, remember?
Frauker turned. Nerol's las pistol was aimed directly at his face. The ginger-haired killer grinned.
On a side note, Frauker said, it would have been nice if you'd got my back too, Carly.
20.
Ow,
said the hunter in grayscale armor. He gestured with his double-bladed harn knife. Patience got up and slowly came out of the pumping station cavity. The hunter's drone circled her, purring softly.
Gonna fight?
He asked. She shook her head.
Good girl.
Step out here.
She came out. The hunter keyed his voxlink.
This is grade. I've got her. Game's done. Tell Lockiter that my master Vivian will want his winnings in small bills, so he can pay me off nice and handsome.
The hunter looked at Patience.
Why are you smiling?
No reason.
He settled his grip on the alien blade.
Sure you're not thinking of trying something dumb? I'd hate that. It'd make me take a lot longer with you.
I won't fight, Patience said.
Good.
Because Kara told me I don't have to anymore.
Who? Who's Kara?
The girl who told me her friend was coming. She told me to have patience, because patience is a virtue.
The hunter, Grade, looked around edgily.
No one here but us, girl. No sign of any friend of yours.
Patience shrugged.
He's coming.
A wind picked up, stirring the dust and the grit around them, billowing the filth up in swirling clouds, like an exhalation from the sumps of the towering city. Except it wasn't. Larger pieces of trash lifted and fluttered through the air, pebbles rolled on the ground. It was like a hurricane was gathering over the slums. No hurricane. Alarmed, Grade grabbed the girl, viced her neck with one powerful arm, and raised the harn blade to deliver the kill stab.
Cooming Grade, I know you. I know everything about you. I know the 9 counts of murder that you are wanted for, and the 57 other killings you have on your clammy soul. I know you killed your own father. I know you understand only hard cash and killing.
What? What?
The hunter wailed in terror as the tempest of wind engulfed him and his prey.
I don't carry cash. No pockets. I guess it's going to be killing, then.
I turned on my chair's stab lights so I became visible as I ploughed in through the tumult of dirt and dust. The hunter screamed, but the dust choked him. Gagging, he threw Patience aside and drew his Etva C2 plasma cannon, a pistol-sized weapon more than capable of burning clean through my armored chair. Staggering, half-blinded, he aimed it at me. With a simple tap of my mind, I fired my chair's psi cannon. The hunter's corpse slammed back through the wall of the pumping station. Even before it had hit the wall, every bone in that body had been pulped by concussive force. Every organ exploded. The wind dropped. Grit pattered off the sealed body of my chair.
Patience?
She got up. I wasn't using Kara Swole's voice anymore.
Are you all right?
She nodded. She was singularly beautiful, despite the dirt caking her and the tears in her clothing. Tall, slender, black-haired, her eyes a piercing green.
Are you Kara's friend?
She asked.
Yes.
Are you Gideon?
Yes.
She stepped forward and placed her right hand flat on the warm canopy of my support chair.
Good. You don't look anything like I imagined.
21. So we're dead? Yeah, of course we are, Frauke said softly.
You'd be dead already, replied Darol. I just wanted to find out which bastard was running you. Who is it?
Finkster? Rotash?
That'd be right. Rotash always wants a slice of the boss's gameplay.
Neither, actually. Frauke smiled.
Frauke,
Carl began, terrified. He'd backed away as far as the gig's scan console would allow, and even then knew there was no hope. This killer had them both cold. Carl wondered where he'd left his weapon. The answer, in the cabin lockers, did not cheer him up.
Who, then?
You won't know him. His name's Ravener. Darol sniffed.
Never heard of the frig.
Untouchable? Frauke asked, casually indicating the limiter around Darol's throat.
Uh-huh. You too?
Frauke smiled. Made that way, so help me. Still, the pay's decent. Always someone who needs a good blunter, right?
I hear that.
Darol grinned. Oh well, Frauke sighed. Do me a favour, okay? Make it clean and quick. Back of the head, no warning.
Sure.
I mean, one blunter doing a favour for another. We got to stick together, right? Even if we are working for rival crews?
No problem, said Darol.
All right, Frauke said, and turned his back. Any time you like? Darol aimed his pistol again.
I don't suppose...
Frauke began. Then he shook his head. No, I'm taking the piss now.
What?
Asked Darol.
Yeah, what?
Carl squeaked in frozen terror.
One last stick? For a condemned man?
Darol shrugged.
Go on.
Frauke took out his lac, set a low stick to his lips, and lit it with his igniter. He breathed in the smoke and smiled.
Oh, tastes good. Real mellow.
Want one?
Nah,
said Darol. Real smooth, said Frauke, inhaling a long drag.
These things'll kill you, you know.
I wouldn't worry about that, Darol smiled.
I don't freaking believe this,
Karl whined. Hey, said Frauke, glancing over his shoulder. Why don't you do him now while I'm smoking this baby? Save time. I never did like him.
Oh, throne!
Karl cried out and fell into a fetal position under the console.
Freak, what baby?
Darol laughed. Tell me about it, Frauke said. He stubbed out his smoke. All right, ready? He held up the squashed butt. Know what that was, my friend?
Don't tell me, smirked Darol. Best smoke of your life.
No, said Frauke quietly. It was delaying tactics. Darol swung around. The hulking shape of Harlan Nail filled the hatch behind him. Nail's Hecate 10 boomed once.
Everyone alive?
Nail asked, stepping in over the twisted body of the ginger-haired man.
Saw you approaching on the scanners, Frauke said. Thought I'd keep him talking.
Karl Thonius got to his feet, shivering with anger and fright.
You're unbelievable, Frauke,
he hissed. Thank you, Karl, Frauke smiled, and sat down with his book again. See? Now you're team-building, too. 22. I led the girl back to the gig, where the others were waiting.
Hello, Patience. I'm Kara, Kara said. Good to know you, Patience replied.
By the time we raided Lockerter's manse, backed up by a full squad of magistratum troopers, the narco baron and his cronies had cleared out. There are warrants out for all of them. I understand Lockerter is still on the run. We returned to the Kindred Youths Golem and resumed the interrogations. It took several weeks, but by the end of it, I'd wrung some precious facts out of Cyrus and his staff. There wasn't much. No, that's a lie. There was enough to ensure that Cyrus would face further interrogation at the Inquisition facility on Thracian Primaris, and enough to make sure the Skolam's tutors and rigorists would remain incarcerated in the penitentiaries of Urbitane for the rest of their natural lives. And a lead. Not much, but a start. From Cyrus, just before his mind finally snapped, I learned that Moloch was heading for the Outworlds. Sleef, perhaps. Maybe even deeper than that, I instructed Nail and Kara to provision for what could be a long, dangerous pursuit. The day before we were due to leave Sameter, I met with Karl in one of the Skolam's old, faded classrooms. Most of the staff had been shipped out by then, in magistratum custody.
"Did you trace what I wanted?" I asked.
He nodded.
"It's very little, with the records wiped.
What have you got?"
"Pupils Prudence and Providence were sold to a free trader who called himself Vinquis. The name was false, of course. No other records remain, and the name doesn't match any excise log I can get from Sameter out traffic."
"The man himself?"
"There was a picture in Cyrus's mind, and in the minds of several of the other tutors present at the supper, but they're not reliable. I fed them through both the local magistratum files and the officio itself. Nothing."
So they're lost. Karl nodded sadly.
"I suppose if we dedicated the rest of our careers to trying to find them, we might turn up some clue. But in all reality, they're long gone."
"I'll tell her," I said, and slid out of the room. Patience was in the oubliette, by choice. The hatch was open. She sat inside, in the semi-dark, sliding her hands over the stones. She was still wearing her torn and filthy uniform. She'd refused to take it off.
Patience.
She stared at me.
"You can't find them, can you?"
I thought for a moment, and decided it was better to lie. Better a lie now than a lifetime of hopeless yearning. "Yes, Patience, I found them."
"They're dead, aren't they?"
"Yes." She coiled up, and I felt her hold on to that small black nugget in her mind again.
"Patience."
"Yes, Gideon."
"I'm sorry. I truly am. We have to leave soon. I'd like you to come with us."
"With you? Why?"
"I'll be honest. I can't leave you here. You know about your gift. What it means."
"Yes."
"You're a psyker. A telekine. You can't be allowed to remain in public. But I can look after you.
I can train you. You could come to serve the God Emperor of Mankind at my side. Would you like that?
Better than an apprenticeship to a mill, she said. Will Kara be there?
Yes, Patience.
All right, then, she said, and stepped out of the oubliette to join me.
If you follow me, it will be hard at times. I will demand a lot of you. I will need to know everything about you. What do you think to that?
That's fine, Gideon.
I'll be asking you questions, probing you, training your gift, unwrapping who you are.
I understand.
Do you? Here's a test question, the sort of thing I'll be asking you. What was it that you held on to when the hunters were closing? I felt it as a dark secret part of you, something you wouldn't let go.
It was my name, Gideon, she said. My true name, my real name. It was always the single thing my mother gave me that I didn't ever give away to the bastards in this place.
I see. That makes sense. Good. Thank you for being so honest.
Gideon, do you want me to tell you my real name? I will if you want.
No,
I said.
No, not now, not ever. I want you to hold on to it. It's your secret. Keep it safe, and it will keep you sane. It'll remind you what you've come through. Promise me you'll keep it safe.
I will.
Patience is a fine name. I'll call you that.
All right, she replied, and started to walk down the hallway at my side. I'll need a surname, though, she said at length.
Choose one, I replied.
She looked down at the monogram embroidered on her ragged Skolam-issue clothes.
Kiss,
she suggested.
I'll be Patience Kiss.
That was Playing Patience, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth.
Thorn Wishes Talon, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. The past never lets us go. It is persistent and unalterable. The future, however, is aloof, a stranger. It stands with its back to us, mute and private, refusing to communicate what it knows or what it sees. Except to some. On Nova Derma, deep in the leech-infested forests of the Eastern Telgs, there is a particular grotto into which the light of the rising day star falls once every 38 days. There, by means of some secret ministry and ritual craft that I have no ready wish to understand, the blistered seers of the divine fratery coax the reluctant future around until they can see its face in their silver mirrors and hear its hushed, unwilling voice. It is my fervent hope that what it has to say to them is a lie. That night, the waste world called Melinta had 6 visitors. They left their transport, dark and hook-winged, on a marshy floodplain, slightly bowed over to starboard, where the landing claws had sunk into the ooze. They proceeded west, on foot. A storm was coming, and it was not entirely natural. They walked through streamers of white fog, crossing outcrops of green quartz, lakes of moss and dank watercourses choked with florid lichens. The sky shone like filthy tinted glass. In the distance, a pustular range of hills began to vanish in the rain blur of the encroaching elements. Lightning flashed, like sparks off flint or remote laser fire. They had been on the surface for an hour and had just sighted the tower when the first attempt was made to kill them. There was a rattle, almost indistinguishable from the doom roll of the approaching thunder, and bullets whipped up spray from the mud at the feet of the tallest visitor. His name was Harlan Nail. His tall, broad physique was wrapped in a blue mesh body glove. His head was shaved, apart from a simple goatee. He raised the heavy Hecuta pistol he had been carrying in his right fist and made a return of fire into the gathering dark. In answer, several more unseen hostiles opened up. The visitors scattered for cover.
"Were you expecting this?"
Nail asked as he crouched behind a quartz boulder and snapped shots off over it.
"I didn't know what to expect."
The answer came telepathically from Nail's master, and seemed far from reassuring.
"How many?"
Nail called out. 20 meters away from him, another big man called Zeph Mathwin shouted back from cover.
"Six,"
echoed his estimation. Mathwin was as imposing as Nail, but his skin was dark, the color of varnished hardwood. His black hair was plaited into strands and beaded. Both men had been bounty hunters in their time. Neither followed that profession any longer.
"Make it seven," contradicted Kara Swole, as she wriggled up beside Nail, keeping her head low. She was a short, compact woman with cropped red hair.
Her voluptuous figure was currently concealed beneath a long black leather duster with a fringe of Laracel fur around the neck.
"Seven?"
queried Nail, as whining hard round smacked into the far side of the rock.
"Six,"
Mathwin called again. Kara Swole had been a dancer acrobat before she joined the band, and ordinarily she would defer to the combat experience of the two ex-hunters. But she had an ear for these things.
"Listen," she said. "Three auto-rifles," she identified, counting off on her fingers. "Two lasguns, a pistol, and that."
She drew Nail's attention to a distinctive plunk, plunk. "That's a stabber." Nail nodded and smiled.
"Six,"
Mathwin insisted. "Kara is correct. There are seven. Now, can we deal with them, please?" Their master's mind voice seemed unusually terse and impatient. Not a good sign. One of several not good signs that had already distinguished this night. The two other members of the team sheltered against a gravel shelf some distance to Nail's left. Their names were Patience Kiss and Carl Thonius. A slight, fussy, well-bred young man, Thonius held the rank of interrogator, and was technically the master's second in command. He had drawn a compact pistol from inside his beautifully tailored coat, but was too busy complaining about the weather, the mud, and the prospect of death by gunshot wounds to use it. Patience Kiss suggested he might like to shut up. She was a slender, pale woman, dressed in high boots of black leather, a bell skirt of grey silk, and an embroidered black leather shirt. Her hair was pinned up in a chignon with silver clasps. She scanned the view ahead, and located one of the hostiles firing from the cover of some quartz rocks.
"Ready?"
she yelled over at Nail.
"Pop 'em up,"
he replied. Kiss was telekinetic. She focused her trained mind and exerted a little pressure. The quartz rocks scattered apart across the slime, revealing a rather surprised man holding an auto-rifle. His surprise lasted about 2 seconds, until a single shot from Nail hit him in the brow and tumbled him leadenly onto his back. With a spiteful grin, Kiss reached out again and dragged another of the hostiles out into the open with her mind. The man yelled out, scared and uncomprehending. His heels churned in the ooze, and he flailed his arms, fighting the invisible force that yanked him by the scruff of the neck. There was a blurt of noise, like an industrial hammer drill, and the man ceased to be, shredded into pieces by heavy fire. Mathwin had shot him. His left hand was a burnished chrome augmetic, and he had locked it into the governing socket of the lethal rotator cannon that he was wearing strapped around his torso. The multi-barrels whirred and cycled, venting vapor. The firing ceased.
"They have fled for now. They will return, I have no doubt."
The master of the team moved among them. To the uninformed, Inquisitor Gideon Ravener appeared to be a machine rather than a man. He was a box, a smoothly angled wedge of armored metal with a glossy, polished finish, from which even the approaching lightning seemed unwilling to reflect. This was his force chair, his life support system, totally enclosed and self-sufficient. The chair's anti-gravity discs spun hypnotically as he advanced. Inside that enclosing chair, one of the Imperium's most brilliant inquisitors and most articulate theorists lay trapped forever. Years before, at the start of a glittering career in the service of the Ordos, Gideon Ravener had been struck down during a heretical attack, his fair and strong body burned and fused away into a miserable residue of useless flesh. Only his mind had survived. But such a mind. Sharp, incisive, poetic, just. And powerful, too. Kiss had not met a Psi capable, remotely strong enough to master Gideon Ravener. They were sworn to him, the five of them. Nail, Thonius, Swole, Mathwin, and kiss, sworn and true. They would follow him to the ends of the known stars, if needs be, even when he chose not to tell them where they were going.
The divine frattery practices a barbaric initiation process of voluntary blinding. Sight, as one might expect, is considered their fundamental skill, but not sight as we might understand it. Novices sacrifice one of their eyes as proof of their intent, and have that missing eye replaced by a simple augmetic to maintain everyday function. The one remaining organic eye is then trained and developed using ritual, alchemic, and sorcerous processes. An initiated member of the fratery may therefore be identified by his single augmetic eye, and by the patch of purple velvet that covers his remaining real eye at all times except for circumstances of cult ceremony. A novitiate, self-blinded in one socket, must work to fashion his own silver mirror before he is allowed his augmetic, or indeed any medical or sterilizing treatment. He must cut and hammer his dish of silver, and then work it with abrasive wadding until it is a perfect reflector to a finesse of 0.0088 optical purity. Many die of septicemia or other wound-related infections before they accomplish this. Others, surviving the initial infections, spend many months or even years finishing the task. Thus, members of the cult may additionally be identified by blistering of the skin, tissue abnormalities, and even significant necrotizing scarring incurred during the long months of silver working. It is also my experience that few fratery members have codable or matchable fingerprints. Years of scrupulous endeavor with abrasive wadding wear away hands, as well as silver. Overhead, the sky flashed and vibrated. Kara could hear the thunder and felt the drizzle in the wind. Fog vapor smirched out the distance. With the toe of her boot, she gingerly rolled over the body of the man Nail had shot. He was dressed in cheap, worn, foul-weather clothes, made of woven plastic fiber and leather. He had one augmetic eye, crude and badly suited into the socket, and a velvet patch over the other.
"Anyone we know?"
asked Nail, coming up behind her. Unlike the others, Nail and Kara had not been recruited for Ordo service by Ravenna himself. They had originally owed loyalty to Ravenna's mentor, Inquisitor Gregor Eisenhorn. Somewhere along the line, a decade or more past, they had become Raveners. Kara often thought of Eisenhorn. Stern, fierce, so much harder to bear than Ravenna, Eisenhorn had nevertheless been a good man to follow. And she owed him. But for Gregor Eisenhorn, she would still be a dancer-acrobat in the circuses of Bonaventure. She often wondered what had become of her former master. She'd last seen him back in 87, during the mission to 5213X. He'd been a wreck of a man by then, supported only by his burning will and fundamental augmetics. Some had said he'd crossed a line and become a radical. Kara didn't believe that. Eisenhorn had always been so hard line. She thought of him fondly, as she did the others from that time. Elizabeth Beckwin, God Emperor rest her, Dear Amos, Medea Betancourt, and Fischig. They had known some times together. Great times, bad times. But this was her place now.
"Fiss doesn't ring any bells," she said.
She reached down and lifted the eye patch, just out of curiosity. A real eye, wide and glazed, lay beneath.
"What the hell is that about?"
Nail wondered. Kara reached up and slicked the short red strands of her rain-wet hair back across her head. She looked across at Mathuin and Thonius beside the other body. Thonius was, as ever, elegantly dressed, and as he crouched in the mud, he fussed about his shoes. Thonius was Ravenna's pupil, which supposed that one day Thonius was to be promoted to full inquisitor. Ravenna had been Eisenhorn's interrogator. Kara wondered sometimes if Karl had anything like the same stuff.
"If you'd left him a little more intact, we might have made a decent examination," Thonius complained.
"This is a rotator cannon," Mathuin said bluntly. "It doesn't do intact."
Thonius prodded the grisly remains with a stick.
"Well, I think we've got an augmetic eye here, too, and what's either an eye patch or a very unsatisfactory posing thong."
Thonius's caustic wit usually drew smiles from the band, but not this night. No one was in the mood for laughs. Ravenna, generally so forthcoming with his team, had told them virtually nothing about the reasons for coming to Malinta. As far as anyone knew, he'd simply diverted them to this remote waste world after receiving some private communique. Most alarmingly of all, he'd chosen to join them on the surface. Ravenna usually ran his team telepathically from a distance via the wraithbone markers they all wore.